Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. I'm wearing the green today, and a shout out to all my friends who are Irish or would be Irish. And here's my favorite Irish band to open up the show today. And as Bono sings about the desert sky from the album Joshua Tree, I'll let you know that I'm going to take a few days off to go explore the California desert. Our next podcast will be next Monday or Tuesday, depending on exactly when I return. And I picked the tune In God's Country because Israel positions itself, both internally and externally, as a religious nation, as God's people, God's chosen people. That's what the Bible says. And so it is shocking to see just how low a desperate Benjamin Netanyahu will go to try to hold on to power in Israel. Today is election day, and voters have to go in and hold their noses, because the stench has intensified. Yesterday, we told you how he finally admitted that if he is reelected, he would never allow the creation of a Palestinian state. And that shows that he's been bullshitting for years, pretending, going through the motions of negotiations, talking about the prospect of peace. But his true intentions are now clear. And as the polls started to open, increasingly worried that he could lose, Netanyahu lashed out at the country's Arab voters, expressing alarm that an expanded turnout by them could determine the outcome. And opponents accurately accused him of bald-faced racism. And this really does expose the virulent apartheid sentiments that are growing in Israel. There's a significant Arab population. They are citizens of the state of Israel. And as one critic said, no other Western leader would dare utter such a racist remark. Imagine a warning that starts, say, in the United States. Our rule is in danger. Black voters are streaming in quantity to the polling stations. And Netanyahu, quoted in a video, said, right-wing rule is in danger. Arab voters are streaming in huge quantities to the polling stations. The left-wing nonprofit organizations are bringing them in buses. Doesn't that sound like the way the right-wing in this country sounded the phony alarm that Acorn was, you know, illegally registering voters multiple times and getting them to vote multiple times, busing them to different polling places? It was all a lie. But, hey, it worked in the United States, and so I guess they'll try it out in Israel. And as if the racism and his belated honesty about his true sentiments about the prospects of negotiations with the Palestinians weren't enough, Netanyahu's Likud party admitted that they forged a recording of the leader of the Kulanu party. His name is Moshe Kalan, and Kalan was a member of Netanyahu's Likud party and then bailed out. He only hopes to capture 8, maybe 9 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. But because this election is so close, the Likudniks forged a recording which suggested that Moshe Kalan had endorsed Netanyahu. So this really shows how low Netanyahu will go to try to hold on to power. And what's fascinating about this, Al Jazeera reports, that the Arabs are voting in larger numbers because there was an effort made to further marginalize them by the far-right-wing coalition or far-right-wing element of the Likud coalition. And you probably know the name Avigdor Lieberman. He is the foreign minister. And he is the guy who has been trying to eliminate non-Jews in the state of Israel. He's very open about it. So after he heard Netanyahu's comment that Arabs are voting in droves, he tweeted, Netanyahu also knows that if the Arabs are voting in droves, only a strong Lieberman can stop them. Well, Lieberman had written the law that was passed by the Knesset, which raised the threshold from 2% to 3.25% for a party to get a seat in the parliament. This was clearly an effort to elbow out minorities, and in particular, Arabs, who I will repeat, are citizens, full citizens of the state of Israel. And the Arabs are splintered into many different parties, and they've had to close ranks in order to overcome this new obstacle that was placed before them. And there is one other note worth passing along here from the Al Jazeera story about this, and that is that the so-called center-left coalition of Isaac Herzog and Zippy Livni may not be that different from Netanyahu, particularly on dealing with the Palestinians. And so we're in this kind of dark spot where a guy like me hopes that Netanyahu is defeated and then crosses fingers hoping that the replacements will not be the same or worse. Well, 4 years on in the Syrian civil war, we have a new allegation that the army, the military of the government led by dictator Bashar al-Assad, used a chlorine bomb in an attack on a village over the last couple of days. The death toll is reported to be low. The town of Sarmin in Idlib province was the location of this alleged attack. Videos showed medics in gas masks dousing victims with water, children lying immobile on hospital beds, foaming at the mouth. Now, there's also a report, and this is separate, that last Saturday, Kurdish Peshmerga fighters near Tikrit in Iraq were the subjects of a chemical weapons attack believed to be chlorine, and they later found 20 gas canisters loaded onto a truck that belongs to the Islamic State fighters. So this is a kind of escalation or descent into hell. You choose, and the ugly killing will continue. Every day I like to pause and thank people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I couldn't do it without you. And I just signed up a new subscriber today. We will thank him at a future moment because I don't have his name right in front of me. So today I will note that Andy Krieger, Christopher Welsh, Annette McManus, and there's Andy Krieger again with a second subscription. They're all generous supporters of this podcast, and I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the sign-up link. It's right under my picture on the homepage. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever is suitable for your budget. And our best deal is the annual $50 rate. New annual subscribers get a bonus gift. It's an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos, his latest book. Brad Friedman has been digging in to the case that we learned about last July. Federal Judge Mark Fuller, the man who railroaded former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman into federal prison where he remains to this day. Mark Fuller was accused of domestic violence. The call came from a suite at the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta. And his latest wife, who had been his court clerk and he had an affair with her that broke up his previous marriage, his current wife, Kelly Fuller, in tears, reported that she was being attacked. Mrs. Fuller stated when she confronted him about their issues and she accused him of having an affair with his current clerk, he pulled her hair, threw her to the ground, and kicked her. She then claimed she was dragged around the room and Fuller hit her in the mouth several times with his hands. So Brad Friedman of bradblog.com has dug up the full 911 phone call recording. And it contradicts the assertions made by Barry Ragsdale, who is the lawyer for Judge Fuller. He claims that Fuller acted in self-defense, that his wife was mistaken about the affair and she was emotional and she went after him. But in the full recording, Brad Friedman reports at BradBlog that she says that she's in a domestic dispute requesting an ambulance before the sharp cracks of what sound like at least five smacks are heard during the recorded call. The 911 operator is then heard calling an ambulance dispatcher and telling her, "I can hear him hitting her now." Then the two of them trade angry shouts of, "I hate you, I hate you." And then the woman tells the 911 operator, "Please help me, he's beating on me." So we now have a judicial counsel investigation of the 11th Circuit, which is the court where Fuller is appointed to a lifetime job. They've heard 3 days of testimony last month in a hearing that Ragsdale said was essentially a trial. And the results of the investigation due later this month allow the counsel to make no recommendation, reprimand Fuller, request that he resign or retire, or recommend that the Congress begin impeachment proceedings to remove him from the federal bench. And so we will continue to follow that case. And I'll just let you know that we're working feverishly here, and in a couple of months we will announce an exciting new series related to the trials and tribulations, the prosecution and persecution of Don Siegelman. Well, I flipped on the TV this morning. I rarely do that. I prefer not to watch television early in the day. It's just a waste of time. But I was hoping to see some coverage of the Israeli elections. Instead, I got wall-to-wall coverage on all the cable channels of the testimony of Joe Clancy, who's director of the Secret Service, before the House Appropriations or Administration Committee. And what I heard him say is that his agents deal with a lot of stress. You can sure understand that. And they don't all just go do yoga or Pilates. Some of them drink. And he, of course, is on the hot seat because of the incident a week ago where two top agents went out drinking, then came back to the White House, disrupted a crime scene investigation, bumped a car into a barricade, and just generally embarrassed themselves. So Joe Clancy goes up to Capitol Hill and says, "My agents have a lot of stress. Would you give me $8 million to build a White House mock-up?" Huh? Now, he claims that in Beltsville, Maryland, about 20 miles from the White House, the Secret Service has a training site. But they can't really train properly because they don't have a fake White House. I mean, this is just so infuriating. And to claim that the problem with the Secret Service is that they need more reality-based training exercises, that's not the problem, Mr. Clancy. The problem is that your guys think they're above the law, that they can sleep with hookers and then not pay them in Colombia, that they can be undisciplined when people jump the White House fence. I mean, it's just really crazy. And I'll bet he's going to get that $8 million. I just bet. So John Brennan is the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, right? And he made some bizarre comments recently regarding the role of social media in the struggle against the so-called Islamic State, Daesh, IS, ISIL, whatever you like to call them. And what is bizarre, you're about to hear John Brennan explain that social media makes it harder to fight so-called terrorism. Let's listen to the director, and then I have a couple of comments about that.
I do believe that you still have a significant number of individuals who are traveling to Iraq or Syria, trying to join up forces with ISIL, as well as attaching themselves to different franchises around the world. At the same time, though, I think the great image of ISIL in terms of its being able to prevail and be successful inside of Iraq and Syria is being pierced, because we see that they are having setbacks. We see that there is some dissension in the ranks. We see that a lot of the requirements that are attendant to having control of territory and having the responsibility to run it administratively is not really the strong suit of some of these thugs who are joining this bandwagon. So I do think we're seeing right now some very significant indicators that ISIL's engine is suffering. That doesn't mean that it's out of steam. It means that it is going through, I think, a phase of its development, and hopefully of its ultimate demise, that is, I think, consistent with some of the experiences of other groups.
So John Brennan gives us this mixed assessment. But in there, he says new technologies can help groups like ISIL coordinate operations, attract new recruits, disseminate propaganda, and inspire sympathizers across the globe. Well, what he doesn't mention here is he tries to sell us on more surveillance, more monitoring of social media to protect us from these dark, dark threats, is that our use of social media makes their job so much easier. We self-report our location, who our friends are, what we're thinking about, what news items we care about. And all of that is collected by our government, and they can create profiles on us where they know quite a bit. And so Mr. Brennan, I think, is full of it. Now, John Brennan was the drone meister at the White House. As you recall, President Obama wanted to make him CIA director back in 2009, but because of his history at the agency and connections to torture, he passed. And Brennan remained a top White House advisor in charge of the drone programs. And it's John Brennan who has told us that at certain times, zero civilians were killed by our drone strikes aimed at killing so-called militants. Well, on Monday, the ACLU filed a lawsuit trying to get access to Obama administration documents specifying the criteria for being placed on the so-called kill list for drone strikes. The information sought by ACLU includes long secret analyses establishing the legal basis for what the administration terms its targeted killing program and the process by which the administration determines that civilians are unlikely to be killed before launching a strike. And this suit proceeds after the administration disclosed none of the counterterrorism documentation through Freedom of Information Act requests that started back in 2013. And I'll note that today, the White House celebrated Transparency Day and quietly announced that it is changing some protocols to make it even more difficult to use the Freedom of Information Act to access administration documents. Yes, transparency. The Obama administration says it's the most transparent in history. And, you know, that is hardly true. So it's interesting to see. I hope the ACLU will prevail in this case, but it's unlikely. The government has many levers it can pull to prevent disclosures. And Jamil Jaffer over at the ACLU says the categorical secrecy surrounding the drone program doesn't serve any legitimate security interests. It only serves to skew public debate, to obscure the human costs of the program, and to shield decision makers from accountability. Well said, Jamil. Well said. In New York, well, let me put it this way. Last week, the founder of Wikipedia published an op-ed where he announced that Wikipedia was suing the NSA, requesting that it stop surveillance of people from outside the United States who access Wikipedia, looking up information. And now we learn that the New York Police Department cares so much about what's up on Wikipedia that they apparently have someone assigned to sanitize postings to try to minimize the egg on the face of the men in blue in New York City. Men and women, I gotta include the women, I know there are some. So, for example, in the case of Eric Garner, a line in the Wikipedia listing said Garner raised both his arms in the air. But that was changed to Garner flailed his arms about as he spoke. Then there is the line, push Garner's face into the sidewalk. It was changed to push Garner's head down into the sidewalk. And then on a line, use of the chokehold has been prohibited was changed to use of the chokehold is legal but has been prohibited. So I really wish that the New York Police Department, if it really wants to enhance its image, it should stop using brutality instead of trying to clean up the record about the brutality it has used. Yesterday on Huffington Post, my friend Lisa Ray linked me to an article there that was shocking in a wonderful way. The headline reads, "For the first time ever, a prosecutor will go to jail for wrongfully convicting an innocent man." And I have followed the cases of innocent people wrongfully convicted for over 30 years. I have never seen a case where the prosecutor who intentionally withheld evidence, who intentionally convicted the wrong person, was held accountable or paid a price in any way. Most of them get promoted, often to become judges. And so it is some satisfaction to learn that former prosecutor and judge Ken Anderson has pled guilty to intentionally failing to disclose evidence in the case that sent an innocent man named Michael Morton to prison for the murder of his wife. Morton remained in prison for 25 years while Anderson got promoted to judge. Now, it's a slap on the wrist. He pled to criminal contempt. He has to give up his law license, 500 hours of community service, and only 10 days in jail. Gosh, I'd like him to serve 10 days for each of the 25 years that Michael Morton had to serve. But this is stunning, and I hope it's an example that will be followed in jurisdictions across the country, because we've seen many men exonerated and released. Do we ever see the people who got them locked up punished? Well, this is the first case that I have ever seen. A little bit of good news on the climate change carbon emission front. Now, I'm not here to tell you that the problem is solved. We have more harrowing news of ice melting both on the North Pole and the South Pole. And clearly, the problem has not been addressed in any meaningful way. But despite that, a new study shows that energy producers held the line on carbon dioxide emissions in 2014, the first time in 40 years of measurement that the level didn't increase during a period of economic expansion. So back in 2008-09, there was a drop in carbon dioxide emissions, but it was clearly related to the economic downturn. And so this shows that energy efficiency, alternative sources, all of that is finally starting to gain some traction. And it is a tipping point, perhaps, that the carbon dioxide emissions for 2014 did not go up. The other day, the New York Times ran a story about Al Gore, Mr. Climate Change, that he has become more optimistic. It reads, over the last year, the prophet of doom has become much more a prophet of possibility, even perhaps an optimist. Still an object of derision from the political right, Gore has seen support for his views rising within the business community, investment in renewable energy sources like wind and solar skyrocketing. And so there are some people who I have seen float the possibility of Al Gore running for president in 2016. Now, there are a lot of complications, and I, for one, am intrigued by the possibility because he could make climate change a signature issue and really change the political landscape. But of course, he, you know, in taking on Hillary Clinton, it would open up all those old wounds. And let's be honest, I don't know where Al Gore stands on a lot of current issues. I don't know where he stands on Guantanamo, on surveillance, on the war in Syria and Iraq. He's been largely silent on many important issues. He does pipe up on climate change, and I appreciate that. But I will say that right here, right now, I would prefer Al Gore to Hillary Clinton, and we could work out the details later. Now, how about Martin O'Malley? The Guardian did an interesting profile on him last week. He is the former governor of Maryland who has announced an exploratory campaign for president. And he seems pretty serious about it. He's been dropping coin for other candidates to earn political favors by deploying some of his staff people to elections for sympathetic individuals who might support him later. And I honestly don't know that much about O'Malley, but this article paints him as a fairly progressive guy, although he's a fairly wonkish data crunching kind of fellow. It says that in 8 years as governor, he achieved an impressive progressive policy record. During his tenure, extensive environmental legislation was passed to protect Chesapeake Bay. Gay marriage was legalized. Minimum wage was raised. The death penalty was abolished. Undocumented immigrants were allowed to get driver's licenses. So, those are promising descriptors. He also has tweaked Hillary by coming out in favor of reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act, which would hopefully reinstall the firewall at banks. So, tell me more, Martin O'Malley. Again, you're not Hillary Clinton. You're against the death penalty. Well, those are two instant scores in the positive column at the Peter B. Collins scorecard. And while we're talking about presidential candidates, I've got to scratch my head because the Times did a profile on Friday the 13th about Carly Fiorina. And while I'm not commenting that much on most of the Republicans who say they want to run for president, we'll let them sort it out and talk about them when they get more serious. I just think it's bizarre. Carly Fiorina is a total failure. She was the first major CEO of a tech company when they hired her from Lucent to run Hewlett-Packard, and she ran it into the ground. I mean, Meg Whitman has had to come out of retirement to fix Carly's blunders. And there was one CEO in between them. Now, we should remember that Carly was fired. How many CEOs get fired in this country? The number you can count almost on one hand, two at the most. So Carly Fiorina is sharpening her skills as an attack dog. And with a kind of tip of her hat to Sarah Palin, she doesn't have Sarah's quick wit or that kind of bubbly personality. But Carly has been on the attack against Hillary Clinton. And, for example, Hillary claims she's traveled hundreds of thousands of miles around the globe. And Carly says, I have too. But unlike her, I've actually accomplished something. She told that to conservatives in Iowa without detailing any of those accomplishments. She said, for Mrs. Clinton, flying is an activity, not an accomplishment. Now, she recently tweeted, after Hillary's news conference about the emails, in effect, Hillary Clinton just told us to trust her. Nothing in her track record suggests we should do so. Now, I think that's actually fair. But it is snarky, and Carly Fiorina is going on the attack early, and I think she's running for vice president. That's not too far-fetched. But she wants to be the anti-Sarah Palin, a woman who goes on the ticket, who is not a liability, and who becomes the kind of, slice-and-dice mudslinger for the ticket. Now, it's interesting because Carly Fiorina has also accused Hillary of stealing intellectual property. Carly Fiorina published a book in 2006 called Tough Choices, Hillary's book last year was called Hard Choices. Recently, when Hillary came to Silicon Valley to rally with 5,000 female tech professionals, Hillary urged them to unlock our full potential. Well, Carly Fiorina's Political Action Committee is called Unlocking Potential Project. It's going to be a wild ride from here to 2016. I recommend helmets, seatbelts, and other safety devices. Thanks for listening to my news and comment all the way to the very end here. I do appreciate it. I'll be back at you next Monday or Tuesday. And feel free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.